You cannot understand the Black freedom struggle unless you understand the role of faith in the Black freedom struggle. And so it's not just the pastors or whomever who were Christian. The bulk of the movement was, and some of the selectivity of the figures who I chose was because they were the ones who the historical record, I could demonstrate that faith was playing a role, not just that they believed in general, but that their belief was leading them toward this action to resist racism.
Welcome back to the DEI podcast. I'm Max Gaston. My guest for today is New York Times bestselling author and Notre Dame alumni, Jamar Tisby. Jamar recently published his new book entitled The Spirit of Justice: True Stories of Faith, Race, and Resistance. The book shines a much-needed light on the often-overlooked heroes of the racial justice movement. It tells a compelling collection of stories about courageous individuals from past and present who fought against racism and advocated for liberation, all while grappling with their faith. As a country that is still navigating our ongoing struggle for racial justice, Jamar's book provides not only a more accurate account of our past, but also inspiration for a more just future. Here is my interview with Jamar Tisby. Jamar, welcome to the DEI podcast.
I am so honored to be here, especially as a Notre Dame alumnus. So thank you so much for having me on the show.
I really have to say, before we even get into it, congratulations on this book. I was reading this cover to cover, and I mean, as you can tell, I've got all of these
different... I see the tabs.
Every single page I was underlining and starring. I mean, we could be here till midnight, but I'm not going to do that to you. But this, this was such an incredible book to read, and it's actually out today. We're talking about this on the day that it's releasing. So first and foremost, congratulations on this book, and how does it feel to have this out?
Thank you. I'm feeling so much gratitude. We hustled our butts off to market and promote this book for, you know, a lot of reasons, particularly because the context around racial justice conversations has become so fraught lately. It's really hard to get a hearing, really hard to get these books published, really hard to get them, you know, in the hands of people. So my gratitude comes from the folks who are sharing, who are posting, who are reviewing, and people who are just supporting me as a person, but also my work as an author. So just deeply, deeply grateful for that support.
So where I want to start with you is on a more high level discussion about the spirit of justice, and then we can get into some of these really great themes from the book that I think you outline really well. But generally speaking, the book dives deep into the relationship between faith and the continuing struggle for racial justice across different historical and contemporary contexts. And in the first few pages, you say something that I really like. You say, "The spirit of justice is reflected in the human spirit, the indomitable will of oppressed people everywhere to rise up and throw off the burden of injustice." Then you go on to say, "We see that spirit of justice expressed in those who struggled for freedom against apartheid in South Africa, colonialism in India, and labor exploitation in Mexico. It is the irrepressible instinct that says, I will not endure indignity. I will make you see my worth, and you will treat me accordingly." Talk to me about what this book is about in general and why you felt compelled to tell this story.
I think the spirit of justice is the that's not right spirit. Like when we experience something or even observe something, people being mistreated, and we say that's not right. Things should be different. That's the hint of the spirit of justice in us. And that phrase comes to me from a real life eyewitness encounter I had with Merle Evers Williams, who folks will remember. She is the spouse and the widow of Medgar Evers, who was assassinated in front of their home for his work with the NAACP. And she was at the grand opening of the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, December 9th, 2017. And she gives this public address, which I don't even know how she found the strength to, because she had taken a private tour just before. And the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum has on display the exact rifle used to murder her husband. So I can't imagine like seeing that in person and then going wow. and giving a public speech. And then she held a press conference afterwards that I was just privileged to be at. And I'm so grateful. It was just one of those God moments. I had my cell phone out and recording when she said this. A journalist asked her a question. How does racial justice now in the 21st century compared to then in the civil rights movement? And she said, you know, honestly, I'm seeing stuff I hope I would never see again. And there are a lot of echoes of the past I'm seeing right now. And then she said she was weary, which was like the understatement of the century because she was 84 years old. This is back in 2017. Right. So of course she's weary. And I fully expected her to be like, it's up to y'all. I'm passing the torch to the next generation. Good luck. Right. She didn't do that. She said, but there's something about the spirit of justice. Then she has this really descriptive analogy of a war horse being put out to pasture, but it hears the bell, which she calls the bell of freedom, and it gets stiff and straight and ready again. And then she said, you become determined all over again.
Hmm.
And that whole episode stuck with me, especially that phrase, the spirit of justice, because what stuck out to me was evil is unsurprising. Injustice is always going to be present. What's truly remarkable is the fact that there are always a people willing to rise up and resist it. And those are the people who I am saying tapped into the spirit of justice. And that's what I wanted to write about.
It's really interesting. You know, you start the book with the time before the transatlantic slave trade, and you really take us through all of these different stages of history leading up to today and the Black Lives Matter movement. And so it's interesting that you start and end the book with Merle Evers Williams, because the idea of a woman who saw something during the civil rights era, who is now today still seeing it happening again, it's one of the themes that I thought was really interesting in this book. I call it the past is prologue. The way that I hear you say it in the book, it's the idea that racism never goes away. It just adapts. And yes. We see it manifesting in different ways, whether it's slavery or the Jim Crow era, what we fought for in the civil rights movement, to the post-civil rights era and today. And so you talk about the different ways that people express the spirit of justice. Mm-hmm. Across these different movements, across these different timelines, through resistance, advocacy, and activism. Can you talk us through what each of those different approaches looks like and how they play a role in the fight for justice?
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. You know, one of my goals in the book was to show the breadth and the variety of what it looks like to push back against racism. And I wanted the reader to have a sense of like why I was including such disparate examples, because we have in our minds this idea that resistance to racism is like really public, really overt acts like marching or lunch counter sit-ins. But it's much more expansive than that. And so I talk about the difference between resistance, advocacy, and activism. And these aren't hard and fast lines, but I think they give us a decent framework for understanding what resistance can look like. So resistance is itself anything to push back against your dehumanization. And often it's not even conscious on your part. There's a social media account called the NAP Ministry, NAP, like sleeping. And basically, they're proposing the idea that like just getting rest in a society that wants to exploit your labor is a form of resistance. And in the book, I talk about Anthony and Isabella, who had, you know, quote unquote, the first African-American child. They were enslaved directly from Africa, but then they have a son named William in North America, making him African-American. Right. And I say that even having a family and all the hopes and the dreams and the ways you try to raise that child, that's a form of resistance. So it's really expansive in that sense. But there's another level, and these aren't holier levels than others, just a different way to think about it. Advocacy is the next one. And advocacy is conscious, and it's about awareness raising. So think about sharing social media posts or articles. Think about donating to a cause or even volunteering with a cause. that's advocacy. And I think a lot of people were catalyzed in like 2020 to be advocates for racial justice. But then there's a whole other group of people in activity called activism or activists. And those are the traditional kind of front lines people. These are the community organizers, the nonprofit leaders, the people who are dedicating substantial amounts of time and perhaps even on occasion putting their bodies on the line for justice. And those, you know, are some loose distinctions I outline between resistance, advocacy, and activism.
You know, it's interesting when you were tying these all together, you were talking about this idea that the stories you tell in this book are disparate, but I sort of see them as complementary to one another. You know, you see things that are happening in one period of history recurring in the next period of history, just in a different way. But so, you know, the book again, you know, moves through the transatlantic slave trade up until today, and you talk about some of the biggest contributors to the civil rights era that we know of, like Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Dr. Martin Luther King, and also folks that people may not be so aware of. You talk, for instance, about Phyllis Wheatley and Charles Hamilton Houston.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think is really interesting about what you do in this book and really sets it apart is that you center the faith of those individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a theme I would really love to dig into here with you. Why did you feel that it was so important to highlight the faith of the people that you talked about? And how does focusing on faith, instead of maybe putting it in the background where it tends to go when you talk about civil rights activists, how does centering their faith maybe change the way that we look at them?
So I have my PhD in history, and what I noticed was that even when historians spoke or wrote about the civil rights movement in particular, they would sort of elide the role of spirituality, Christianity, the church. Now, they would cite it, but more on a very practical level, like this is where they met before the march, or, you know, these people were ministers, right? But they wouldn't really delve into how a person's spirituality or religiosity actually animated their activism. So I wanted to reinsert that into the dialogue about the Black freedom struggle, because quite simply, you cannot understand the Black freedom struggle unless you understand the role of faith in the Black freedom struggle. And so it's not just the pastors or whomever who were Christian. The bulk of the movement was, and some of the selectivity of the figures who I chose was because they were the ones who the historical record, I could demonstrate that faith was playing a role, not just that they believed in general, but that their belief was leading them toward this action to resist racism. So I wanted to highlight that. And then, you know, another reason is the very oft proposed question, an understandable one, which is Christianity the white man's religion? Understandable because it's so often used to oppress others and to put people in bondage, especially in U.S. history. But also, there's the witness of the Black church. And so I wanted to highlight the ways that Black people, even if the message was coming through enslavers or segregationists, were able to hear the voice of Jesus proclaiming liberty to the captives and, you know, relief to the people who are oppressed.
Yeah, two thoughts come to mind when you say all of that. The first one is this line that you referenced, which I loved, where you said, "For those who claim the Christian faith, one might understand the spirit of justice as the Holy Spirit," which I think is such a beautiful, just a beautiful line in the first place. But referencing specifically the Black church and this idea that Christianity is not the white man's religion, can you talk about the emergence of the Black church? You know, where does that come from and how its role throughout history and how it's evolved has been pivotal in the civil rights era and is still quite important today?
I love that question because it's so central, again, to understanding resistance and the Black freedom struggle. So first of all, Africans come with a spirituality, come with a cosmology, right? And I make an explicit point, as many historians do, that our history doesn't begin with slavery. It begins on the continent. And there were a variety of religions and spirituality practiced in Africa. And what I highlight in the book is that one of the ties among all those different spiritualities is that religion was holistic. There wasn't a sharp line between the material and the spiritual, which is in contrast to some European theologies and approaches to religion, right? Which is to say, when Black people practice religion, it's an embodied religion. It's not just a religion of the by and by, let's wait till we die. This religion has impact here and now, which leads them to justice work. And then when, first of all, some Africans who were enslaved were already Christian. There were Africans who, in census records and whatnot, had Christian names, particularly Catholic names. So Anthony and Isabella, who I mentioned earlier, likely would have been baptized Catholic, and they baptized their son William, probably Catholic. So that's there. So Christianity's in Africa even before, you know, enslavement. And then as it develops, in the first and second Great Awakenings, especially, is when you get large numbers of African descended people in North America converting to Christianity, and they make it their own from the beginning. From the beginning, they gravitate toward books like Exodus and see themselves in the enslaved people of Israel, but with God delivering them, right? And always hoping and praying and working toward that. And it's really after the Civil War when you get Black Christianity coming into its own. So this is the birth of a lot of historically Black denominations, excepting the African Methodist Episcopal Church was a bit before. But I love that the chapter, because I didn't call it the Jim Crow era. I call it the Black institution building era. And Black people used our newfound freedom to build and build enduring institutions, central institution of which was the Black church. So I talk about Reverend E.C. Morris. He's on the cover of the book. He's the first president of the National Baptist Convention, which today is the NBC USA Inc., largest Christian body of Black people in the country. And it has always been religion, and Christianity in particular, part of what motivated the Black freedom struggle. So I just wanted to highlight that in each of the more than 50 figures who I profile in the book.
I mean, there are so many different areas that I want to just dive into with you. I'm trying to kind of control myself with all of it. But one of the things that I think is really interesting that you say is that there would be no Black church without white racism. and you talk about this idea of, again, you know, faith being tied into racial justice, how Black people who were enslaved were inspired by their faith, and that was one of the things that pushed them forward. But something else that's really interesting about this sort of dichotomy between why the Black church emerged and sort of in part in response to experiences of racism is where it positions the white actors during the slavery era, where you talk about how can Christians justify enslaving other Christians, especially during a time where Thomas Jefferson and the rhetoric of the American Revolution is all men are created equal. You know, you talk about how Frederick Douglass, for instance, said that throughout his written recollections, he described the deplorable behavior of those who claimed to be disciples of Jesus Christ. How did white Christians during the slavery era reconcile their Christianity and the rhetoric of freedom with enslaving people who were Christians but who also happened to be Black?
That is the question. How can it be that the religion of a brown-skinned Palestinian Jewish savior who preached freedom and grace and love, how can that be the religion of slave trading and human bondage? Well, the answer is it can't be. but what white Christians did was develop a theology that justified what they were already doing and believing. So one of the fundamental flaws in our understanding of an approach to race is that it is primarily an issue of attitudes and feelings. It's people not liking each other because of the way they look. That's part of it. But really, the heart of it is money. A lot of people say that slavery or racism was America's original sin. And I say that racism is America's original symptom, but its original sin was greed. By which I mean, what accounts for the resilience of race-based chattel slavery? It's the chattel part, which means property. It's the money principle. It's the fact that people were making a lot of money, North and South, North America and Europe, were making a lot of money by not paying exploited laborers. And then they come up with a theology that says, well, God meant for this to be. So they come up with the curse of Ham, which was really curse be Canaan. But they said, well, the descendants of Ham are African. And so they were cursed by God to be perpetual slaves. So we're just following what God said. Or in the Civil War, you get pro-slavery theologians saying, well, show me chapter and verse where the Bible condemns slavery. Well, in the Old Testament, it does condemn something called man-stealing, right? And then Northern or abolitionist theologians are saying, but what about that, you know, golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated, love your neighbor as yourself kind of thing.
Right.
And they're saying, no, 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 the Bible never explicitly condemns it. Even segregation, they're coming up with passages from the Bible, like from Leviticus, that says you shouldn't mix certain cotton or certain fabrics, right? And saying, well, just like you shouldn't mix certain fabrics, you shouldn't mix people. And so all of these contortions to justify a sense of superiority and to protect a way of gaining profit for really a very, very small number of people.
So we have the emergence of the Black church. You have a seeming hypocrisy in the white Christian community during that period as well. The other thing that you talk about is the emergence of white allyship through advocates from, for instance, the Quakers to the Methodists who worked for racial justice alongside Black people during the slavery era. Can you talk about how those efforts helped shape the abolitionist movement and what lessons contemporary allies can draw today from those actions?
Yeah, you notice, sprinkle a little salt among that pepper. it's there because, I mean, fundamentally, this is about a human principle of freedom and equality. And so anybody of any race or ethnicity can tap into that, can promote that. I wanted to highlight what it looks like for white people to actually come alongside in solidarity in the Black freedom struggle. And it's costly. So I talk about Charles Morgan Jr., who actually wrote about my first book, The Color of Compromise, because he gave a speech right after the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, where four little girls were killed in 1963, talks to this all-white group of businessmen in Birmingham. And he asked them a question. He says, who did it? Who threw that bomb? And he said, the answer should be, we all did it. And he was demonstrating this idea of compromise and complicity that so many white Christians exhibited in the face of racism. But I didn't tell the second part of the story until this book, The Spirit of Justice. So what happened to Charles Morgan Jr. after that? He immediately starts getting death threats. There's one incident in which somebody follows his wife and son, lists every place they were and the exact time, and then sends it to Charles Morgan Jr. to say, hey, we are watching your family. If you don't cut this out, they're going to become, you know, swept up in this too. And eventually, I mean, very quickly, he has to leave Birmingham, the place he called home. And one of the sad parts, their son had to give away their two pet dogs. Can you imagine? Oh, it's just crushing, right? But then he also goes on to this lifelong career of civil rights law and defends Muhammad Ali as he's protesting the draft in the Vietnam War, defends Julian Bond as he is unjustly denied his legitimate seat in the Georgia legislature. So it's very costly and it tends not to last long. So I talk about John Wesley, one of the founders of Methodism, being a very outspoken abolitionist and saying Christianity and slavery are not compatible. But then at the onset of the Civil War, you have a split between Northern and Southern Methodists, and you get something called the Southern Methodists, which anytime you hear that word Southern before a Christian denomination, it means pro-slavery. So it doesn't always last. And I wanted to give some examples that A, it can be done, but B, count the cost, because there's always a consequence for breaking ranks.
Mm. One of the abolitionists that you talk about in the book that I was really intrigued by was David Walker. Mm. And you pointed out that, you know, one of the things that he said was that one of the most deleterious effects of racism was the internalized sense of inferiority that it forced on the oppressor. That was really interesting to me. And you go on to say in those pages that Walker was especially angered at the pointed effort by white people to keep black people in ignorance.
Mm.
You say that if knowledge is power, then white people wanted to keep black people powerless by preventing them from learning to read, write, or access the Bible for themselves. This idea that knowledge is power and power needs to be held among a privileged few in order to keep a broader community from accessing it and maybe rising to a certain level, that's really interesting to me. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about how keeping black people ignorant was, and even today still is, a strategy for suppression, and how faith played a crucial role in countering that strategy.
Yes, this is so vital. So we've all heard probably by now of the slave Bible, a Bible that was selectively edited purely to encourage obedience in the enslaved. And so literal parts of the Bible were cut out. And that is simply a physical symbol of what white supremacists were trying to do to black people. They were inculcating a narrative of subservience and obedience and inferiority. And the only thing that could undo that was knowledge.
Mm.
Exposure to the whole Bible, let's say, or even literacy and learning about other people and other ideas, right? So David Walker, he's famous for writing David Walker's Appeal, which was a pamphlet. It was so subversive and such a threat to the white supremacist establishment that people had to sew it in the lining of their coats in order to hide it and keep it from detection, right? They had to smuggle it to enslave people because reading this might inflame the spirit of justice in people and they would rise up and demand freedom. And we're seeing this today. So what is the history that is being so opposed right now? It's advanced placement African-American studies. It is diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. It is labeling everything as critical race theory or woke. Why? Because these ideas are subversive still, that if people get it into their minds and their hearts that they have equality and that they should demand equity, then it will disrupt a system that benefits a privileged very few. So always, 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 I'm a professor of history at Simmons College of Kentucky, which is a historically black college founded in 1879. Mm-hmm. I'm saying to my students who are otherwise not terribly interested in history, I'm like, this knowledge is potentially disruptive in ways that people want to prevent you from even having it. So learn it as best you can, because this is an empowering history, an empowering information that can change the life for you and generations to come.
Mm. You also talk about how keeping black people in ignorance has helped to fuel the stereotype that black people are inherently less intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
A stereotype which, again, is still alive today. You know, just take, for example, the rhetoric that Donald Trump has been using about Vice President Kamala Harris, saying that she's not an intelligent person. You know, the examples in the book show how this idea that black people are less intelligent or that black intellectualism doesn't really exist, That's actually not true. And really what holds black people back a lot of the time is a lack of opportunity. You know, it's not a lack of talent or lack of intelligence. Can you share some of the stories from the book that illustrate how, you know, how this has played out for individuals who've managed to stand out and achieve despite the barriers set forth to keep them from accessing information and knowledge?
There are so many stories of black people taking advantage of the very limited educational opportunities they have and just running with it. So one of the most fascinating stories I came across is about Anna Julia Cooper. She was a lifelong educator. And actually, there's a quote from Anna Julia Cooper on U.S. passports today. The quote says, "The cause of freedom is not the cause of a race or a sect, a party or a class. It is the cause of humankind, the very birthright of humanity." And the reason I bring up Anna Julia Cooper, she attended the prestigious M Street High School, now known as Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, which is a historically black high school in Washington, D.C. And she also earned a PhD from the Sorbonne in Paris in 1925, by which time
really
she was
by that.
66 years old. I know. She wrote it in French. It's just like mind-boggling, right? And she's a teacher as well. And she pioneered what later, you know, the model, which basically becomes the community college model, two-year associate's degree. And she had this deep, deep, deep concern for black people and education, particularly black women in education. So she's one example. I also talk about Coretta Scott King, who often, you know, stands in the shadow of her husband, MLK. But she was brilliant in her own right. She graduates as valedictorian of her high school. She gets a scholarship to the New England Conservatory of Music to study singing. She's exposed to pacifism and nonviolence well before she meets Dr. King, and is a human rights activist and protester in her own right before and after his assassination. Becomes a global human rights activist and icon of equality and civil rights. So education was a huge part of that. I talk about Charles Hamilton Houston, you know, law school lawyer. I'm sure y'all talk about him. But this man was brilliant. I mean, just a voracious reader. And he talks about lawyers being social engineers and transforming society for the better of people and not just to line your own pockets with wealth. So these were highly educated people, and they did not have many opportunities. They could only go to certain schools. They often only got a certain level of educational attainment, and yet they took what they had and just, you know, turned water into wine, so to speak, educationally. Mm.
You also talk about the importance of and the power of black people obtaining financial independence, with examples about people like Paul Cuff. Can you say a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. So black people are entrepreneurs. You know, I think of so many figures who started their own businesses, right? So I think of Prince Hall, who was a black person alive in the 1700s, and he basically scrapes his way by into starting his own shipbuilding company and becomes one of the wealthiest black people in New England, and uses his wealth to advocate for black equality and black freedom. So he helps bring a case about Belinda Royal or Belinda Sutton, depending on the records you look at, which is counted as one of the first known cases of any sort of reparations being paid on an individual basis to an enslaved black person. She had been enslaved to this white person who died. She had never gotten paid for her service. She sues basically for back pay and retirement and wins the case. And that's Prince Hall helping him. He also started the Freemasons for black people in North America. I think about Elizabeth Keckley. Is such a fascinating woman. She was born enslaved. She has a son by her slave owner, but she's a fabulous dressmaker. And wherever she goes, people just love her work. Eventually, she is able to save up enough money working on the side to buy her own freedom and that of her son. And they move to Washington, D.C. She quickly becomes enmeshed in the elite, white elite of Washington, D.C., and is making dresses for the wife of Jefferson Davis before the Civil War. And then during and after, she is the dressmaker for Mary Todd Lincoln, the spouse of Abraham Lincoln. So she's in the White House, and that's her own business. She started by word of mouth saying, hey, I'm making dresses. Do you want one? And gets into these elites, then uses her wealth to provide relief for recently freed Black people from the Civil War and Union soldiers who are Black.
Mm. So I want to shift to focusing a little bit more on the civil rights era focus of the book. And one of the things that was really striking to me was the attention that you paid to talking about the experiences and the leadership of Black women during the civil rights movement. Why was it important for you to specifically highlight the experiences of Black women during the movement?
So I just wrote an article about the March on Washington, and it was an enormous success in a lot of ways. But the day after the march, Black women headed up by Dorothy Height had a meeting called After the March, What? The reason they had the meeting was because they had been stonewalled by the Black male leadership that didn't want to include women as a more prominent part of the program, especially speakers at the march. And so these Black women got together and said, listen, these men ain't doing right by us. Even white women and white feminist groups aren't doing right by us. We have to make sure that our concerns are front and center wherever we go. And so they invite Polly Murray there, who's an Episcopal, first woman Episcopal priest, Black woman Episcopal priest, and a theologian and an intellectual. I think she was a lawyer too. And she talks about Jane Crow at their next meeting. And talking Jane Crow being, related to Jim Crow, but it's the intersection of being both Black and a woman. So that idea of intersectionality far predates the term intersectionality. And Black women understood that they had those dual oppressions to deal with of racism and sexism. So I thought it was critically important that we highlight Black women not only as part of the masses and not just a part of the marchers, but Black women really as masterminds of the movement, people who came up with the strategies, who thought out the plan, who executed the plan, and who are long overdue for the recognition and attention that their contributions deserve.
I do feel like there's this big trend, not just during the civil rights era, but maybe across history, of Black women being the unsung heroes of so many victories, not the least of which is the fact that a lot of Black women drove the success of the efforts during the civil rights movement, even if it wasn't the prominent Black female figures, the ones who were just showing up at the rallies to the March on Washington, the ones who were just there, whereas a lot of Black men weren't always there. You know, and it sort of foretells the future of what we know now of Black women kind of always sweeping in and saving the day. And like you said, not really always being acknowledged for doing that. I wonder if you can talk about this part of the book that I really loved, where you talk about the Black Madonna. And I want to talk about it from the perspective of Black women experiencing adversity and being reflected in their faith through the Madonna, but also along the lines of this idea that representation of Black iconography is something that can really help uplift and motivate people in a social movement.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up. That was in the section on Albert Clegg Jr., who pastored a church in the Civil Rights and Black Power era that he renamed Shrine of the Black Madonna. And the reason it was called that was because on Easter Sunday one year, he unveiled this big mural. It's 1967. He unveiled this big mural in the church that showed a Black Madonna and child. So, chocolate skinned, Mary and chocolate skinned baby Jesus. And that was really subversive at the time, because even in black churches, you had these images of a white European looking Jesus. And on that Easter Sunday, Clegg preached a sermon, and he said, you know, instead of a sermon, we could just sit here and look at the chancel mural of the Black Madonna. And he called black churches, he said, we issue a call to black churches, put down this white Jesus who has been tearing you to pieces. Forget your white God. So he was advocating for an Afrocentric, black-centered Christianity and spirituality, directly in contradiction and opposition to white European-looking iconography. And most people can picture in the 1940s, a guy named Warner Salmon painted a painting called Head of Christ. And that's the one where Jesus has this flowing auburn hair, these blue eyes, this sharp nose, you know, thin lips. It's like, oh, okay, Jesus came from France? I don't know. And so Clegg and many others during this era, especially in the 1970s, the sort of Black consciousness era, Black power era, people wearing dashikis, growing their hair out to afros, it's a reclamation of the dignity of being African descended and then representing that even in the religious sphere. Mm.
So the civil rights era was characterized in part by the idea of nonviolence, peaceful protest. And something that's really interesting about that to me is the parts of the book where you talk about self-defense and the need to protect yourself against people who are actually posing an immediate threat to your bodily safety. Can you talk about the sort of split that we saw within the Black community during the civil rights era of people who were really intent on just this idea of do no harm, even to the people who are harming you, versus those individuals who were saying, I have a right to protect myself in the face of a threat to my life?
It's a really important nuance to history that we don't understand very well. So we think of the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King Jr. especially as nonviolent. And that's true. But the way people understood nonviolence could differ. So MLK was an example of a principled nonviolent historical figure. You could even call him a pacifist in many ways. There's this one really powerful example that I'm surprised doesn't get talked about more. But King is on stage one day giving a speech, and a white supremacist is in the audience. They had no way to tell who was who, right? And so he's in the audience, and he literally runs up on stage and starts beating King physically, just punching him. Mm-hmm. And King doesn't retaliate whatsoever. He basically just covers up, falls to the ground to protect himself. That is a principled nonviolent stance. And even afterwards, he says, don't call the cops, bring him backstage. I want to talk to him. Talks to him. Guy's unrepentant. But that was King's approach. He was a principled nonviolent actor. Most Black people were tactical nonviolent people. That is to say, it was a tactic of protest that if they went out for a march, if they went out for a demonstration, they wouldn't come carrying guns and clubs and bottles. They would come unarmed. And even if violently attacked, oftentimes at the hands of law enforcement, they wouldn't retaliate. But that was a measured, thought out tactic to bring about a desired end. However, they were not pacifist in the sense that if the Klan came after you or your family, if you were attacked, you know, randomly on the street, not part of a protest or something like that, they said, you're darn right, we're going to defend ourselves. And we have the right to, and any human being would. And there were some Black people who went so far as to say to men, well, you're not even a real man if you aren't, you know, protecting yourself and your family and your community in these physical ways. So it wasn't a let's go out, conduct guerrilla warfare and attack whitey kind of approach to violence. It was, if attacked, we will defend ourselves. And even if I use nonviolence as a tactic for protest, on a personal level, I retain the right to physically and violently defend myself against a violent attack. Mm.
Something that you talk about throughout the book, and I think it weaves in pretty well with what you just said, is the spirit of resilience amidst oppression that a lot of these Black heroes needed to find in order to keep going. You know, the historical violence and the systemic oppression have repeatedly sought to extinguish the spirit of resistance within Black communities. But despite those efforts, the resilience, it perseveres. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about how you think this enduring spirit has managed to maintain itself, and how does it continue to manifest in today's activism efforts for justice?
Yeah, how that spirit maintains itself is really, I think, the heart behind the book, The Spirit of Justice. And I think the answer is the spirit of justice. And so It is this, like I say, it's the human spirit. Whether you're a Christian or a person who practices any religion or none at all, there is this sense in us of the that's not right spirit. There shouldn't be this way spirit, right? And with a few people who demonstrate enough courage, that rises up and it demonstrates itself in external actions to oppose injustice. I also think, you know, for Christians, this is the Holy Spirit. This is the one who resides in us by faith in Jesus, right? And so it's always going to be present. It's always going to show up, even if it's in simply a remnant. But on a practical level, the way the spirit of justice perpetuates and is resilient on through the ages, I think, is by the stories we tell. And that's what this book is. Yes, it's history, but truly it's just stories. Stories of the human spirit, stories of the Holy Spirit, stories of the spirit of justice, stories of regular, ordinary people demonstrating extraordinary courage in the face of incredible odds and obstacles and oppression. And these are our stories. That's what I really want people to get a sense of. Like, these are not just stories about the past that are relevant then but not relevant now, nor are they stories of some special class of people that we can look at and look up to, but we don't have access to that. No, this is part of our tradition. We inherit a legacy of liberation, and they have passed the baton to this present generation, and they are not passing that baton without power. They're passing it along with the spirit of justice. So just as they resisted racism in their day, we can resist it in ours. Mm.
One of the things that we were talking about offline was the way that words and ideas and messages and movements can, and sometimes do for political purposes, get misinterpreted. And I want to talk a little bit about that here as well. One of the things that you mentioned is how Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech has in some ways been misconstrued. And you talk about how it's often selectively quoted to suggest that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted to downplay the importance of race and promote colorblind approaches to racism, which he didn't actually support. Can you talk about how the misinterpretation of Dr. King's words has affected his message and how it's applied today?
Everyone loves to pull the one quote out of the context of his speech. I want my kids to be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. It's been weaponized against the very things that Dr. King stood for. So it's been used as this colorblind approach that we shouldn't take race into consideration at all, which was the argument that people used with the Supreme Court ultimately deciding recently that race couldn't be considered as a factor in higher ed admissions, right? That is not what King was saying by color of skin and content of character. Even in that one speech, he talked a lot about systemic and institutional injustice. And so he talks at the beginning of the speech about the United States owing Black people a debt, and a debt that has not been paid yet. And so what I wanted to emphasize was MLK was not this nice, warm and fuzzy activist who, you know, we embrace as opposed to other people like Malcolm X or anyone else you want to name. No, King had his sharp edges when it came to justice. I mean, he talked about needing a universal basic income or a guaranteed jobs program. When he was in Memphis, when he was assassinated, he was pulling together the Poor People's Movement, which is going to be a cross-racial, inter-ethnic movement of the poor who literally were going to stage a mass demonstration by camping out in the U.S. Capitol until Congress started to make some changes that would lead to a more equitable wealth distribution. Those are the parts of King's life and legacy that we don't want to talk about, and we just want to make him into this avatar for being a post-racial society. And that's just not what his life or words demonstrated.
Mm. Another period that you talk about is the Black Power era, which followed the Civil Rights era. And you talk about the Black Panthers in particular, which this was really interesting for me. You say that they had a clear agenda that was focused on ending police brutality and advocating for truthful education, which I think echoes today the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement and trying to tell our history in an accurate way. But despite the clear objectives of both those that the Black Panthers were advocating for and the objectives that the Black Lives Matter movement today, for instance, is trying to advocate for, both have faced significant backlash and been misinterpreted. Mm. How do you think these historical and contemporary movements are often misunderstood, and why do you think they get distorted?
Any assertive Blackness is going to be vilified and distorted. Mm. What the Black Panthers were doing was asserting a proud, defiant, militant Blackness. We are Black and we're proud. It wasn't colored. It wasn't Negro. It was Black. And then they had the aesthetic. They had the berets. They had the afros, the leather jackets. And of course, they open carried, which today, you know, people on the right would champion open carry, unless it's Black people open carrying weapons, right? And again, it was self-defense. They weren't going on the offense, but if they witnessed police brutality, police wouldn't back down, then they were prepared to use violence, right? And in a similar way, the Black Lives Matter movement is an assertive Blackness, that Black lives matter, right? Not African-American, not Negro, not colored, Black. And they pushed back against conceptions of respectability politics, that you have to dress a certain way, speak a certain way, have a certain level of education to be worthy of dignity and respect, to get white people to give you your due, right? They were pushing back against that. And, you know, whether it's the Black Panther Party, which was, the full name was Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, self-defense against law enforcement as an almost occupying force in Black communities. It's always going to get backlash. It's always going to get pushback. Anytime Black people, you could see this in the slave revolts in the 1800s, right? You can see this in the legacy of the Haitian Revolution, which to this day, they're essentially paying the consequences and the price of rebelling against slaveholders and becoming the first independent, successful slave rebellion in the Western Hemisphere, right? So there's always going to be that backlash. And the lesson here is not to back off from that assertive Blackness. It's to continue to assert it. And if people aren't ready for it, they will have to get ready for it.
Jamar, I could talk to you all day, but we do need to start to wrap up here. So I just want to touch on a couple other areas before we let you go. One of the things that you talk about, and we mentioned it before, is the idea that racism doesn't leave, but it adapts. Mm-hmm. And something that you say on the heels of that message is that resisting racism isn't about perfection, it's about progress.
Mm.
And there's a quote here that I want to read just because I think it's so strong. You say, "The partial progress of so many who resisted racism reminds us that growth is fragile. The gains of the past are not guaranteed to persist into the future. Victories can turn into losses. Rights can be rolled back. Time is not an inevitable march toward a greater freedom and equality. Instead, each new generation must take up its responsibility to embrace the spirit of justice and maintain the struggle of positive change."
Yes.
talk about this idea about how progress doesn't always mean a straight line forward, and how we have to continue pursuing the effort for racial justice, and that the spirit has to continue to live on from generation to generation.
So King popularized that saying, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And people have often remarked, well, only if you bend it. So it's not going to happen by itself. And I would take it even a step further, that objects want to retain their shape. So not only does the arc of the moral universe bend toward justice if you bend it, but if you stop bending it, it's going to go back to that arc being unjust, right? It's going to go back to that original shape of an injustice and unjust arc. So that speaks to the ongoing nature of this. I mean, right even now, we are seeing rights and guarantees that we thought weren't going to go anywhere being rolled back. We mentioned earlier the Supreme Court decision about affirmative action. There's all kinds of machinations around voting rights and making it harder or easier for certain groups, right? So the point is, as Angela Y. Davis, the former Black Panther and now professor, said, freedom is a constant struggle. And what I wanted to convey in the spirit of justice is we have to take up that mantle today. But we do have a great cloud of historical witnesses to draw inspiration from and even imagination from so that we can continue that struggle. But it will be a constant struggle.
Jamar, how can people stay in touch with you and all the important work that you're doing?
Well, I'm so grateful to be on the show. If people want to learn more, of course, The Spirit of Justice is out now. You can get it wherever you get your books or visit thespiritofjustice.com. And since books take years and years and years to actually come into the world, if you want to keep up with my writing more frequently, visit me at my Substack, jamartisby.substack.com, jamartisby.substack.com. And I'm on all the socials at Jamar Tisby.
Jamar Tisby is a New York Times bestselling author and author of the new book, The Spirit of Justice, which, as he just said, is out now. Everyone should go out and get a copy. Jamar, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. I hope you'll come to campus one day and join us in the law school for a talk with our students. We would really love to have you.
I would love to come. Any excuse to get back under the golden dome, the golden glow of the golden dome. Thank you so much for your close reading of the book and a really engaging conversation.
Thank you, Jamar. Take care.
The DEI podcast at Notre Dame Law School is produced by Notre Dame Studios. Every episode, we sit down with important voices in law, culture, society, and business to talk about issues that touch all of us. If you liked what you heard today, become a subscriber and get notified every time we upload an episode. And tune in next time for another great conversation on issues that touch us all. Until then, take care.